hey guys, I was able to get to the meter right before the meter person was going to put a ticket on the llama and the boat. So, whew, dodged a bullet there. So where were we?
Was it difficult for Haley? Did you have to do some splaining about what, like, the kinds of games that you work on, the LARPing, the all that? Did it? Was there a lot of sharing there? And do you want to talk when we do the podcast? Do you want to talk a little bit about what you do with LARPing?
Yeah, like what's your short intro for people who don't know anything about it?
See, I'm trying to think. I feel like I didn't have to explain very much to Dargan because he has the games background. So there's always that sense when you're working with someone who's a media maker or working with someone in games where you're just like, oh yes, I can skip like 40 steps of explanation.
I can skip chapters 1 through 29.
Okay. We're just gonna skip to the very end where the good stuff is.
But if someone has never heard of LARPing, what is it?
Yeah, one difference too though that I came from is I pretty much just play single player games.
Oh.
Okay.
Like I just am extremely antisocial. I like smell like llamas, so nobody wants to be near me.
So lots of Animal Crossing you play or Tetris?
Yeah, Rundle? Totally. So I'm pretty much just single player. So that was another really cool thing game wise.
Yeah.
So learning with Haley was about all these social games, both in person and kind of at the same time, but not. So that was something, honestly, like a lot of video game experiences online for me are horrible, you know?
Like, wait, why is that? Why are they horrible?
Yeah. Just like really toxic communities.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Like, right. You know, and.
Right.
They like totally whoop you at the game too, you know. Yeah. So, yeah.
Well, when you're playing Call of Duty, what do you expect there, Dargan?
Really? Yeah, that's true, that's right? It's true. Yeah.
Well, that's yeah. That's really what you know. One of the things that's really amazing about Haley just is her sense both of communities among players and communities among characters. Like, which then there's always those two levels and. That's, you know, those are the same kind of zones that Mark and I play with in this written improv, this improv where it's that same dynamic. And you're always kind of acknowledging the real person beneath the character and those kinds of things, the social part. So kind of that impulse to communicate in a more compelling way about climate change kind of met the game, sort of a game-like structure. And then one of our beloved featured players, Jean Shramik from here in Duluth, had, you know, not long before you approached us, she had gone to a destination wedding and just been hysterical in kind of giving this portrait of what a, a royal, amazing mess it was in some ways. And so that kind of combined, and we said, well, okay, let's do destination wedding where essentially the place is underwater or the place has been really severely changed by climate change. And I can remember going back and forth with Dargan about, and Haley, like, what's the right date? What's gonna give us the most drama? And then we kind of zeroed in on 2070. And our strategy is, and as I think we presented it to you first was, it's sort of a Trojan horse thing of like, in the guise of a fun family farce, the real drama that's going on is that the climate change is affecting everything. And that seemed to resonate. And I don't know, I just thought it was.
Yeah, and I think the thing that impressed me the most, I mean, first of all, I mean, the whole live action role-playing part of it was, you know, extraordinarily fun that we'll talk about in a second. But when we found out that Dargan's computer models could predict weather to a location, to a date, to a specific date, then all of a sudden, like, that first of all, that just blew my mind because my weather forecasters can't tell me what the weather's gonna be like tomorrow. Well, in Los Angeles they can, but back when I was growing up in Pittsburgh, they couldn't tell me, you know, reliably at all, other than probably not so nice. But that said, this notion that we could have people do this thought experiment and send themselves to that place, that date in the future, and then to sort of radically personalize it what, again, just kind of blew my mind. But I don't know, Dargan, yeah, you
want to
explain
like
your
huge...
computer models at all? I don't know.
Yeah. So climate modeling is what I do for research. And I think just that one concept that like climate models actually have weather in them is not well understood at all, you know? And I think part of the reason of that is that we only show these like line plots of, you know, annual averaged data from it, right? Because that's sort of what the final answer is in terms of climate, right? Mm-hmm. But along the way, there's all sorts of, you know, weather systems passing through, both normal and then getting more and more severe, and there are heat waves and there's extreme humidity, and you know, sometimes the winds come from one direction and sometimes they come from the other. And you know, even in such, you know, there's always some rolls of the dice in there too, essentially, right? There's always some randomness in it, like even in really apocalyptic, you know, extremely humid, high sea level conditions, there's some days that where cold weather comes, right? So you actually do get pretty nice conditions, you know? So I think in terms of having an event where there's so much focus on that one day being perfect, right? Mm. Everybody knows about, you know, the rain on the wedding day, and you know.
Yep. Yes. He raises his hand. The lights went out during my marriage service because the rain in Chicago was coming down so severely. Yes.
Nice. Yeah, perfect.
Yeah. I gotta say, when I reached out to Rob, because I think it was like right after getting off of the light rail, heading back to the boat from visiting Dargan for the first time, you know, I was like, oh, you know, Mark and Rob, you know, just in that kind of manic state of trying to reach out to everyone I know, being like, why aren't we making stuff about climate? And I send this frantic thing to Mark and Rob, like, net prob about climate, come on guys, you know. And I think Mark sent an email like, that sounds really dark. And then Rob was like, weddings. And I was like, oh, weddings, you know, it's brilliant. It's the one event that's so much about the weather, you know. And we don't really maybe acknowledge that as being as important to weddings as like white dresses and you know, some of the other stereotypes, right? But everyone just won't shut up about the weather when someone has a wedding, you know. Oh, look, it rained in that photo. Yeah. What does that mean? It's really strange.
It
seemed like a perfect way to dramatize the topic.
I love it.
Well, I don't know. It's just, I want to just acknowledge that. And be
there's
like,
also so much, like with weddings, so much like family history where you have to get married in that one place.
Oh, exactly. Yeah.
That was way underwater, right?
That was kind of
our
fiction. We randomized, Mark built this beautiful randomizer that sort of had generic relationships, a chart of generic relationships. So you could play with 6 people or you could play with like, I think up to 20 people. But the one of the few constants was that grandma of one of the sides, grandma had decreed and paid for, presumably to a certain extent, the wedding to be at a certain place, which was beautiful in grandma's day, but problematic in 2017.
Yeah. Well, what I love about destination weddings too, and this is something that I was talking about when I shared the piece down in a conference in San Diego, was that the reason why you have a destination wedding is not entirely because you want to go to this beautiful locale, but it's because there are people in your family that you don't want to invite, you know, right? I mean, that's why you make it so prohibitively far, right? Is so that you don't have to invite everyone. But we had worked on the other thing is, so this grew up, one of the things we'll have to go over just briefly during the podcast is, oh no, it's raining in the studio again. Tony, get the pails.
Tony, can you pull those tarps over the electronic, that it's okay if that gets wet, the electronic stuff. Keep that.
Don't
protected.
Let the water get on us or our guests is really the only reason you're holding those umbrellas. Now, Haley had worked with us before on Thermophiles in Love. And that was the first time that I think Rob and I always knew that Neprov had some affinities with LARPing. But Thermophiles in Love was the first time we ever, you know, we collaborated with her and specifically called it a LARP. And I don't know. Just make sure, Haley, do you have a good hunk on that to recap, like, what Thermophiles in Love was?
Yeah, yeah. I guess, you know, we, there's like the long story, the short story.
Whatever one you want to tell. I can always edit it later.
A multimedia piece that included a LARP and a netprov that featured a 5-gender dating game. And sometimes included an elaborate gendering ritual in which Mark and I physically accosted people in a gallery space. Were we wearing lab coats? There was a lab coat vibe.
I think we imagined we were wearing lab coat. Now, by physically accosted, it means we were standing in front of a computer setup in a gallery at SLSA, Society for Literature, Science, and the Arts. And as people would come over, now, the reason why I'm laughing is because we didn't necessarily plan this in advance. I mean, in other words, I didn't sit down with Haley and say, Haley, this is what we're going to do. But we did have the generator, another one of these JavaScript randomizers that I had built, up on the screen. And as people walked up to the podium to look at the project, I all of a sudden just started claiming that it would pick out their perfect, much like you read people's auras or, you know, maybe read their palms or something like that, not to cast aspersions, but that this machine would find their perfect thermophile gender and let us know about it. And
you put an X on the floor in tape, and that was when it all went downhill. You know, it was like a place for the person to stand while this machine that we didn't actually have was supposedly scanning them.
And of course, we're at the Society for Literature, Science, and the Arts, so people thought, well, maybe their technology really is that. I mean, I assume they thought something like that. So, and then the spiel began, like, clear your mind, try not to cloud your mind with other thoughts, because then the generator is not going to be able to read your perfect gender appropriately. Funny because at some point, I remember talking to Haley afterwards, and she said, basically, she was like, yeah, all of a sudden you just started doing this thing. And I was horrified, but I just decided to go with it. And thank you for being a good sport about it. She just went with it. And she became the other scientist, and she picked up the ritual right away. And I think, to be honest, people really kind of enjoyed it, because it's a little bit, all of the genders were a little bit, they were a little bit like,
it was Barnum statements, you know. It was like, so I guess, like, I'd been kind of helping, like, parse the genders. Like, I sort of helped decide it's going to be 5, you know, based on the fact that many societies outside of Western imperialism have multiple genders, and there seems to be this tendency to have 5 gendered societies, you know, like the Burjas in India, in Indonesia, many regions of India, you know, have 3 to 5 genders. I know they have officially 3 genders, like, you know, acknowledged by the state there, but then there are other, like, regional genders and whatnot. So you might get a city with, like, 5 genders and, you know, or 4, depending on where you are. Many two-spirit nations and people in the United States, you know, acknowledge multiple genders as well.
Your descriptions of them were so good too, Haley. Yeah, Haley wrote up like that. She separated them and wrote these little sheets that people would read. It's a very brief, just a couple paragraphs, and it gives players just this real sense of what they are. And then the whole dynamic of both the online version, the written version, was a dating website for these 4 genders.
Matchmaking.
You had to try to make a quadruple, which was 4 of them, because then the 5th gender, and I thought this was brilliant, was a kind of a matchmaker, almost a priest level person, right, or something like that, a conduit to beyond in some way, or something that's going to organize things.
Of the unconscious, the mesophile gender. That was the thing to our collaborator, Kathy Podeswa, you know, brought in thermophiles and this idea of having this be, you know, connected to hard science. So when you were gendered, you received your true thermophile gender. So it was like, a mesophile or a hyperthermophile, or, you know, So each gender is kind of associated with a thermophile. And I mean, we had that process where the four of us as collaborators filled out sort of what the qualities would be for these different genders. And I really think it was like, I was writing them almost like LARP characters. Mm-hmm. And I think it was Rob and Mark who kind of went through and started adding things like, you know, occupation, or, you know, started making them look more and more like horoscopes. And I was like, right. Oh, these are Barnum statements. Oh, gender is a set of Barnum statements. Whoa. You know, it was kind of a mind blowing process just to be working on that, you know, so actively with you guys, because we were working on deadline, you know, to get things ready for the next improv. And sometimes there were things that I just wasn't prepared for in terms of like confronting the reality of what, you know, what imperial gender is, you know, where I was I think deconstructed more than I was ready for today.
I love it. Well, and so that was the thing that I was going to get to, was that with that Barnum statement, that horoscope nature of the genders, no matter what you were assigned, like somehow it loosely fits you. And most people were game to just sort of go with it and then play. And of course, then we had these rounds of speed dating that we ran at SLSA, and we also did at Berkeley. And then we've got groups in concentric circles, and they're rotating and they're quickly meeting their other thermophiles. We created the quadruples, and then we went from there. But I do distinctly remember one person for whom getting assigned, only one person amongst all of these prickly academics and you know, whatever academics are, who again bristled at their assignment of gender. And that's when I knew we were onto something, because they weren't insulted by the process of this, you know, this ruse we were pulling. They just didn't feel like the gender they were assigned fit them. You know,
it's interesting. I remember someone being, you know, bristly about just being like, no, that's not me. I think I'm more of an obly or something, mm-hmm. which was lovely. I did have one person who refused to undergo the
scanning.
Very scientific ritual. And I don't know if you were present for this, Mark, but I've retold this story a couple times, you know, and he was an older man, you know, must have been maybe in his 50s or 60s, who walked up to me and put his face about 3 inches from mine and just, you know, stared at me and said, you realize what you're doing is really dangerous, you know, in this like, you know, kind of like puffing his shoulders up. And I just looked back at him and I'm like, I know, you know, I was kind of like playing into it, you know, I was hoping to kind of make him laugh. And he just like stood there staring, and I kept, you know, kind of cracking jokes about gender until he walked away kind of, you know, huffing, you know, but that was like the one moment where I think someone was, you know, he didn't elaborate on why he felt that assigning people wacky thermophile genders was dangerous. You know, it might've been that the whole lab coat ritual style thing.
Right. Or the sense that we were scanning people's biomes, I think we called it.
Yeah, maybe he was worried about people's biomes. I mean, you know, maybe we were accidentally splicing their DNA and he was worried about radiation. Who knows? With our fake machine that was entirely an improv invention of Mark's. But
That's great. Well, I think one of the fundamental early decisions not to make it about people, but to make it about these one-celled organisms, that just helped a lot too. It was, you know, they're living creatures, but they're so distanced that you can kind of project on them safely. They're kind of, and we represented them in cartoon-like ways, but even conceptually, they're sort of cartoon-like. It's very hard to imagine that, you know, the actual life of these one-celled organisms. And I think that just helped a lot. And I too was just charmed, both in the written version and the reports of the real life version, of just how much fun it was. The one time we did it all together in Berkeley, people had so much fun and just, you know, jumped into the play. And that's something I'm just noting down as a general thing. I want to make this point on the show, is that that's really one of the themes that ties the four of us together, is that, you know, whether it's playing music and doing climate songs, but all of us have play as a kind of serious component of what we do. although I'd never say that, but
yeah, no, you do say it, like the play and go deep side of it from Del Close. But and then thinking about the way that also played out in Destination Wedding 2070.
Ooh, hey guys, we gotta go and get ready. Let's just call this part two, although it's before part three, which is still before the recording of the show. So if we could wrap our heads around that would be great. I'm gonna take a bio break. If anybody has any drink orders, let me know. Just text them to me. I'll go check up on the llama and the boat as well. All right, sounds great. Great.